Hello and welcome to the podcast of moralapologetics.com. Our aim is to get you thinking about the moral arguments for God's existence. We think these arguments have the unique ability to both illuminate the mind and stir the heart. We're glad you're here, and we hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome to episode 8 of the podcast. This week we're going to be hearing again from Dr. David Baggett. And for those of you who are just now getting acquainted with the website or who don't know, this week I'm going to actually spend just a minute here introducing you to Dr. Baggett. With his co-author, Jerry Walls, Dr. Baggett authored Good God, The Theistic Foundations of Morality. The book won Christianity Today's 2012 Apologetics Book of the Year Award. He's working on a sequel right now with Walls that critiques naturalistic ethics, a book to be called God and Cosmos, Moral Truth and Human Meaning. Walls and Baggett are under contract with Oxford University Press for a third book in the series, a book that will chronicle the history of moral arguments for God's existence. And Dr. Baggett has also co-edited a collection of essays exploring the philosophy of C.S. Lewis and edited the third debate between Gary Habermas and Anthony Flew on the resurrection of Jesus. And Dr. Baggett is currently a professor at the Liberty Baptist Theological Seminary in Lynchburg, Virginia. He has taught philosophy for many years, and I think it's safe to say he's really an expert on the issue of the moral argument and moral philosophy in general. So for the context for this episode, we're talking about moral facts. What are moral facts? And the role that these moral facts play in the kind of argument that Walls and Baggett use in Good God is very important, because they use what's called an abductive argument. And the role of facts is very important for what Walls and Baggett are doing in their book, Good God. What they are trying to do is move from certain moral facts, which we're going to discuss what those are today, and consider what best explains these moral facts. So that's what we're doing today. We're talking about what are the moral facts in question and what is the nature of these facts. You can go back earlier to hear Dr. Baggett explain the abductive argument that he uses. But with that, we're going to go straight to the interview. So hope you enjoy it. So now let's talk about some of the what is actually in need of explanation, what the worldview needs to make sense of. And in the book, Good God, you and Jerry Walls lay some of these out. Talk about those just a little bit?
Sure thing. When you talk about the moral facts in need of explanation, the things that come to mind usually first are moral obligations and moral values, right? So this pertains again to what is right and what is good, right? So you can talk about, say, moral facts, such as those. So you have the moral facts of duties and obligations. This is the whole argument of William Lane Craig's. You know, if God doesn't exist, then objective moral values and duties, the good and the right, don't exist, right? So that's what he focuses on.
What would be an example, just quickly, of a moral fact, like what's his name?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it is good to feed the hungry. It is a morally good thing to house the homeless, you know, to treat people with dignity and respect. Here's another moral fact, right, that people are, morally speaking, essentially equal, right? Well, this is in need of explanation. Not everyone in the history of the world has embraced the idea that human beings are, morally speaking, essentially equal. Many have denied it. It's probably a minority position in the history of the world, right? But say on a Christian understanding of things, it makes great sense. God created us all in his image for a reason and imbued all of us with meaning and significance, loves us all infinitely, even if differently, loves us all, you know, infinitely. But he's conferred this kind of value and dignity upon us, this kind of inherent worth. That's a powerful explanation for essential human equality, right? the existence of moral rights would be another, say, moral fact in need of explanation, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, in general, these issues of the good and the right, that's a good place to begin. Beyond that, you have to account for something like moral knowledge, that all of us, it would seem, as human beings, believer and unbeliever alike, are capable of coming to possess moral knowledge. We seem to have the kinds of noetic faculties, or the kinds of intellectual mechanisms by which we can come into possession of moral truth. This is another thing in need of explanation, right? And in our sequel to Good God, we're extending this discussion. In Good God, we primarily talked about issues of the good and the right, a little bit on epistemology and such. But we've really come to see that there are two additional aspects of a moral phenomena in need of robust explanation. And interesting work has been done on some of these, but what we're trying to do is draw all of these together. You got the moral facts, you got moral knowledge, and now you've got these two additional things I'm about to talk about. And interestingly enough, they're both part of what Immanuel Kant called moral faith. Moral faith. Moral faith, on Kant's view, involved two parts. The belief that holiness is genuinely possible, and the conviction that holiness and ultimate happiness cohere, are consistent. And so it seems to me that these two additional convictions would need to be explained as well. You know, in order to believe these rationally, you have to have a worldview with adequate resources to back them up, right? Is genuine holiness possible? Can we be transformed? Can we even be hold out the hope to be transformed entirely into morally perfect creatures, you know, ultimately. And even if we can, right, is that consistent with our deepest joy and happiness? And what we argue is that all of these things can be explained by theism, especially by Christian theism, just so very well. The existence of objective moral duties, objective moral values, moral knowledge, the conviction that complete moral transformation is indeed possible by God's grace, and that holiness and happiness ultimately cohere perfectly.
So is the idea about holiness and happiness being possible, is it the idea of something like, well, if it's not possible for me to be, and we can say, instead of using the word holiness, just say something like the moral life is actually possible, or it's actually possible to achieve the status of being a good person. And is the idea that we have that has to be possible, or else being moral is futile, or what is that necessary exactly?
Yeah. When you give a moral argument for God's existence, oftentimes your atheist friends will kind of bristle, you know, in their response. And this is understandable, I think, and it's largely just based on a misconception you have to kind of clear up. Because I think sometimes they take us as suggesting that atheists can't really be moral people, you know, and they want to say something like, but I'm an atheist, and, you know, and I'm a good person, and so forth. And oftentimes that they are. Oftentimes our atheist friends put us to shame in terms of their care and concern about the poor and the helpless and you know, the disenfranchised and the rest. And expressed in this kind of comparative way, I certainly don't want to imply that, you know, the theists are the moral ones and the atheists are the immoral ones. That's just kind of a misunderstanding of what the moral argument's about. But having established, assuming that we can do this, right, firm theistic foundations for moral facts and moral knowledge, I think it does us good to come back to this question of, is the moral life genuinely possible? And not just in a comparative sense, right? Because sure, if you sort of reduce the demand of morality to something within our grasp, within our reach, we can all talk in terms of, well, we are moral to some extent. We care about people to some extent. We all have good qualities, you know, to one degree or another, right? Believers and unbelievers alike. But you see, what's really, I think, interesting about morality is that embedded within it seems to be a notion that goes considerably beyond the incremental improvement or the comparative goodness. There's something about morality that ultimately demands nothing less than perfection. It's this idea of total transformation, right? And here I just encourage people to sort of look within their own hearts, because speaking for myself, when I look within myself, I still find all manner of of sinfulness, of selfishness, of self-consumption and
of moral
pride,
failures.
Moral failures, yeah. I just don't feel comfortable resting content, with where I am. Like, I'm pretty good. And I point to some folks who are, say, morally worse and say, I'm better than them. Therefore, I'm done with this whole, moral venture, No, I mean, there seems to be something about morality that spurs me on, that says you haven't yet arrived, that you're not nearly as selfless as you ought to be. You're not nearly as altruistic as you ought to be, You still have all manner of unhealthy moral patterns within you that need to be expunged, that need to be excised. You need to be more deeply morally transformed. And ultimately, nothing less than perfection suffices. But truth be told, right, approaching it from this angle, none of us is good. So we're not just saying to atheists, you're not very good people or something like that. Yeah. We're saying none of us is. We all fall short. And of course, this is profoundly congruent with Christian thought that all of us have sinned. All of us have fallen short. Our righteousnesses are as filthy rags and that sort of deal, right? So we find within us this impulse toward moral perfection, but we recognize that when you talk about that kind of moral standard, right, none of us seems able to meet it. None of us, right? By sheer dint of effort, we're not going to be able to attain to this kind of thing. We need to do something. So what are we going to do, right? Lower the standard? Well, that doesn't seem to be the right approach. Exaggerate our capacities? Well, no, I don't think we have the resources. I think if we're honest with ourselves, we just realize we can't do that. We can't attain to that standard, right? What we need is help. What we need is assistance. And this is where I think some of the distinctive aspects of Christian theology can come in so handy to explain this, to make sense of this. That on this sort of view, right, and Kant, Immanuel Kant, said the same thing. We need God's help. We need God's assistance to close what John Hare calls this moral gap between the best that we can do, right, by sheer dint of effort in gritting our teeth and such, and incremental moral improvement and this comparative notion of goodness on the one hand, and on the other hand, this standard of absolute moral perfection. Christianity says that because of what Christ did for us, we can be not only forgiven for our sins, but we can be delivered from sin's power ultimately. And it involves, obviously a process, right? But the culmination of the process, and this is a beautiful promise, right, is that we can be completely morally changed, completely morally transformed. We can truly become conformed to the image of Christ. This is a crucial part of the moral story, it seems to me, that is in need of explanation. I think all of us can recognize within us this desire at some level, however inchoate, to be morally perfect, to be entirely transformed. And theism, Christianity in particular, offers the resources for such hope.
And you also mentioned this idea of that the moral thing to do has to be coextensive with what's ultimately going to bring us happiness and ultimate joy. But what doesn't it seem like often the moral thing goes against that? That, that we talk about the right thing to do often is to give up something that would make us happy or give us joy, it seems like.
I think that this is a view that many people hold and that we're all tempted to hold from time to time, and that it's exactly what we need to call into question. Again, on the Christian story, remember that God is a God of love, and He really wants what is best for us. And if He puts upon us a constraint in our behavior and He says, perform this action or don't perform this other one, right, we might not fully be able to understand His reason behind that. But the idea is He has a reason. He knows what's best, And his wisdom here really ought to be followed. And this is why, say, obeying the commands of God, you know, is such an important part of the process of moral growth, right? Because we're not always going to be able to figure these things out on our own, right? Given our lack of moral sensitivity, moral empathy, given our cognitive limitations, given our, you know, moral fallenness and corruption, there are going to be occasions where God will tell us things that we couldn't have figured out entirely on our own, right? But it's our best wisdom to go ahead and to obey God on that matter, because God really does know best. The conviction that there's ultimate correspondence between happiness and holiness, happiness and the moral life, mm-hmm. is predicated for us as Christians on the deep-seated conviction that God truly is good. God truly loves us. God truly knows what is best for us and what most accords with truth and goodness, with his nature, with the nature that he has given us. And again, it's a common, I think, misconception and a temptation for us all at times to believe otherwise, right? But on the theistic and Christian story, we have this profound reason to believe indeed that happiness and holiness cohere. And Kant recognized this. Kant himself was steeped in the Lutheran tradition, right? And it was from the influence of Christian thought that he came to this firm conviction that to be fully rationally committed to the moral life, you've got to believe that it is in your best interest. And in this way, he wasn't a consequentialist. He wasn't someone who would say, "Hey, this is something that conduces to your happiness. Therefore, do it." Right? But he did think that for us to be fully rationally committed to morality, where we have, say, obedience to God as our highest priority, we have to be able rationally to see and hold the rational hope, right, that following the moral life, following the dictates of conscience, obeying the voice of God, ultimately was consistent and deeply coherent with our highest happiness and our deepest joy. And this indeed is the hope that theism and Christian theism in particular can provide so effectively.
You know, I think that what you're saying helps me to understand what some of the statements that Jesus make that seem, on the surface, they seem contradictory. Like when he says for us to take up our cross and follow him, to make sacrifices, and it sounds like he's asking us to a life of being deprived of things that would give us pleasure. But on the other hand, he also says that he's come to give us life and give it to the full. I think we can make sense of that if we realize that a lot of times what we want, our desires might be wrong, and that God's process, this taking up the cross process, is the process by which we become made into the image or to the likeness of Jesus. And then that is the abundant life.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, yeah. Christ came that we might have life, and that more abundantly, you know. And when he says, you know, take my yoke upon you, you know, my burden is light. My yoke is easy. Comparatively speaking, right, however excruciating the process of sanctification is, it's far less painful than an ultimate relegation to a life of sin, a life of darkness, a life of rebellion, a life of divorce from, you know, the ultimate source of joy and happiness. It's the way of the transgressor that's hard, right, the Bible says.
That's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. When you get a chance, go check out our website. We've got all kinds of new content up there. We have forums. We have essays from literature professors and philosophers. So it's turning out to be a really great resource for people interested in the moral argument. And thanks for listening to the podcast of moralapologetics.com. We'll see you next week.